Expanding upon the theory in biology is a total chance organic evolution. GBT. Understand? And as we said, in the 18th and 17th centuries, cosmology dominated scientific thought. With Darwin, in the 19th century, biology came to dominate scientific thought. And we have seen the failure of chemistry and physics to solve the problem of biology in prebiotic or evolution or chemical evolution. That is the transition from physics and chemistry to biology. In other words, physics and chemistry applies to the non-living world as well as to the living world. But the gap from simple physics, that is, chemical evolution, prebiotic evolution, is an attempt to explain biology in terms of chemistry and physics, that and nothing else. And we've seen the failure of that. I have more to say about that. This is the first edition of the syllabus of an expanded but having understood that, we come now to a consideration of the phenomenon of the growth of science as a mythology. Now, the last thing I talked about, you recall, was the science fiction idea of interplanetary travel, and the point I want to make here is the fact that that kind of science fiction, the fact that evolution, the fact that textbooks will still hold, will still put the Miller Urey and the Fox experiments in there and try to say, well, this is how life, this is spontaneous generation. And the fact that the textbooks will still try to hold to man to amoeba to man, you know, or orthogenic straight line evolution. Try to speak of it, to write about it, as if a continuum existed. As a matter of fact, a continuum does not exist. The fact that those things hold, added, and also considering the fact that the universal, almost Western belief that man shall conquer the stars and shall travel in deep space, this is symptomatic of a mythology. In fact, theory of total chance organic evolution, coupled with the idea of chemical evolution, added to the problem of the origin of matter in the first place. You understand I taught you there's three phases, and to answer one is not to answer the other two. There are three questions: the origin of matter. We talked about the origin of the universe, very serious. Then there's the question: once you got a universe, then you got the question of chemical evolution to produce life, fundamental life. So then you got the problem of biotic evolution, prebiotic evolution, chemical evolution, biotic evolution. Solve one, you understand? The solve one is not to solve the other two. And as a matter of fact, what is happening is that the certainty in high places about the likelihood of ever solving any of them is decreasing. Time was when, you know, as I said, in the 19th of the century, this late in the promise, you know, we're just long, just give us a couple more weeks and we'll have it. But they're not saying that anymore. Now, and so in the light of the decline of scientific assurance, why is there a rise in scientism or the science fiction mentality? Well, science has become a sacred word today. Just as the 17th century was a theological age, the 20th century is an age of scientism. Science is the god. And so we come to the mythology of science. And I follow Rushdoony in this. This is the best word in my opinion on the subject. When we talk about the mythology of science, look at our syllabus now. What do we mean by mythology? We mean the explanation offered by an age or a culture of life and its origins. Now, the word myth does not mean, let's be very careful about this. The word myth does not, in this context, we use myth in this context. It's like when you use myth in a context of cultural anthropology. It does not mean that it's false. Myth describes how it functions. The word, now we normally, in theology, we are attuned, we conservatives are attuned to hearing the word myth, meaning that it's false. You know, the Genesis myths. So we've got to change gears in our thinking and understand that when we're talking about it here, myth simply means the explanation. Myth speaks not of whether it's true or false, but how it functions. And a myth is a functional term. That is, a myth functions to explain origins. Now, it might be a true myth or a false myth. You understand that? In this sense, Genesis 1 is a myth. In this sense, in terms of function, it functions to explain origins. Now, and this is a, because myth means the explanation of life, of origins, and in particular the origin of life, to speak of the mythology of science is something of an oxymoron. You know what an oxymoron is? It's a self-contradicting statement. You know, George Will says that the term Russian journalist is an oxymoron. Because there is no journalism, no such thing as journalism in Russia, because every journalist is functions as an agent of the state. The government. Whereas an American journalist sees their job to try to critique the government. All a journalist in Russia can ever be is simply a mouthpiece for the government.
By American definition of the word journalist.
Oh, by any definition.
Russian's definition of the word journalist might be.
And that means a spokesman. You see the difference between it, say, that Barry Speaks is a well-named spokesman. When he delivers, when he speaks for the president, everybody understands he's simply the president's mouthpiece. The journalists are not called upon to take what he says as gospel. But you see, George Will, this is popping in mind because George Will takes exception to the American networks who will often interview Russian so-called journalists on their TV show without ever telling anybody that these men are simply agents of the state. And therefore, they deliver the party line that and nothing else. So again, they're not journalists. So that's what he said. Yeah, the term Russian journalist is an oxymoron. It's self-contradictory statement. Well, back to my point. The term mythology of science is an oxymoron in a sense. Why?
It's truly science, not scientistic. But it had to be fact. And therefore, it couldn't be myth.
It's true. Let me ask you a question. You think now, see if I'm touching. Somebody tell me why the term mythology of science. What is mythology? An explanation of origins of life.
Oh, science is not explaining origins.
Now, Mr. Eubank, we go by the yes and the only one courageous enough. The rest of us holler, everybody else is hard. So, Mr. Holland said, he said, at least a man put his hand up. Yeah. Well, you want to add to that?
Basically, what you said. Science only deals with what can be observed, it deals with what can be observed, and obviously no one is around the origins, so
as,
can't deal with
right. As Popper said, that evolution by its definition, because it's not falsifiable, can never be anything but a philosophy of biology. By its very nature, it can never be anything but a philosophy of biology. Okay, so first of all, we got the mythology of science is something of an oxymoron, self-contradictory. Now, here's an expanded definition. The attempt of a culture to overcome history. Now think with me on this, what we're saying. That is to negate the forces and ravages of time and to make the universe amenable and subject to man. You see, the purpose of a myth functions, I want you not only to explain origins, but to overcome history in the sense that man it's an attempt to overcome history. That is to say that what has been is not going to necessarily be what shall be, because man doesn't like what has been. What has been is a mess. We'll kind of go, now stick with me on this. Look at the purpose of a myth is to end history. That is, history demonstrates movement, I'm reading now, in terms of forces beyond man and in judgment over man. Now that history shows that man, that history moves apart from man. There was history, but there was a history before man. That man is not in control. Man is not in control. History demonstrates movement in terms of forces beyond man and in judgment over man. That is, the world goes on, man dies. Man dreams, and what happens to his dreams most of the time? They don't make it. They fall to the dust. Man tries and fails. His institutions disintegrate. He gets cancer. He loses his job. His children go on drugs. The car gets a flat tire. Life becomes a little more than waiting for the undertaker. Think about it that way. History demonstrates movement in terms of forces beyond man and in judgment over man. It is inescapably ethical. History is ethical. Shows the conflict between good and evil. That's the great battleground. Good versus evil. Shows man to be the actor, not the playwright, not the director. That's what we talk about, overcoming history. In history, and I use that metaphor because it's good. I think it makes it very clear. History shows that man did not write the script. The man plays the part, but he's not the director. He's not the playwright. You understand? He didn't write the play. And you know, Shakespeare, all earth is a stage, and man, we're all players. We have our fitting existence, and we have our brief time on the stage. Well, in this metaphor, in the Shakespearean metaphor, man did not, he's an actor, and he did not write the script, he's not directing it. But you see, man does not want simply to be an actor. He wants to write the script. He wants to be God. He wants to be the director. Man has never been content to be what he is. So, man uses myth. This is I might call it cultural phenomenon. This is a bit of anthropology. Man uses myth to end history, which means to make himself the absolute ruler. To say, man uses myth to say, all of his myths, whether we're talking about primitive man, pagan man, he says, up to now, history has been in charge, but now I'm taking over. This is how I'm going to do it. Now, if you want to see a clear explanation of this, I've mentioned this before in another connection. Let's go through Epcot, through those what they call them, attractions, and listen to what this, you know, our spaceship work on that. Listen to what they say. It's boys, we're taking over this joint. We're not going to starve anymore. We're going to grow plants in space, and we're going to have super plants. We're not going to die anymore. It's not soon we're going to come. hanging out here on Earth while we're going to start.
Good thought.
Well, it's going to be uglier fat anymore.
We're all going to be mean and handsome and young. We're all going to have a butt now. Everybody's going to be clear-eyed and human limb and rule over angels. Here we are. But now they don't exactly say that. That's the point. Here, listen to that. It's very clear. Very pagan.
Why? What myth? See, before the ancient people used religious myths to do this. And by the way, there is a sense in which Christianity is a myth. In what sense is Christianity a myth? Of course, Christianity is a myth in this context. Don't you understand what I'm teaching? Don't go out of here saying Chambers said that Christianity is not true. It's not a myth in that sense. Does Christianity function to end history? It does. What it says is, up to now, man has been, up to a point now, man has been the victim. You see, what scientism tries to accomplish through science, Christianity accomplishes through the redemptive work of Christ. That is, things are a mess. We have been victimized, but you see, someone, what it is, Christianity is not the message that we are taking over and we're going to solve the problems. We're going to work out the solutions. It is that God has entered history and overcome history in the sense that he has won the victory for us. In Christ, there shall be no more death. In Christ, there shall be no more pain. In Christ, we shall find joy. Y'all see that? It's been bad in the past, but why look to the future? So everything that Christianity offers in Christ, not in us, that's the fundamental difference in its character. Not in us, it is not Muslim. You see, in all other myths, it is man taking over. Man saying to history, you're a simpering old incompetent and you've messed it up long enough, I'm taking over. I am becoming God. And by the way, Epcot, I don't really understand. I like Epcot, but every time I go there, I can't really enjoy it because I see the significance of it. A lot of people go to Epcot, some of those attractions, they're going to church. These are temples. There's a real religious, there's hymns to man. The worship, you want to see churches built to the worship of man. Some of those attractions are what they say, especially when you talk about space and travel to space. Well, anyway, the difference is in Christianity, man does not do it, it's done for us. We are saved by grace. Are y'all with me? This is, don't lose me now. Back up and end again. Okay, so this is the function of a myth in history. What is a myth? It's an explanation of origins. It's an attempt to end history, to make the universe subject to man, that is, to overcome the obvious failure and the death and the destruction. And man wants control, you see. Through my myth, I control the world. I take over. And by the way, this is why it's so dangerous. You see, this new, the neo-charismatics have taken their theology to its logical conclusion, or to one of its logical conclusions, and to say, well, Jesus, you see, the Christian message is, Jesus died to save us from sin. But the neo-charismatic message is, Jesus died to give us power in the universe. To save us, oh yes, but more than that, to give us power over death, over sickness, over death, that is, death now, and to give us power in the universe. See, Jesus walked on the water because he wants us all to walk on the water. Therefore, you get Pat Robertson saying, well, he's turned away to a few hurricanes from Virginia Beach, where there is people have power over nature, power to make it rain, power to make it whatever. Power on control. Or Satan is really sent to somebody like wheat. You see, Jesus, notice Jesus was the Son of God, right? He came to save us, people, men. He didn't have to make us a God. That's Satan's problem. That's the Mormon, isn't it? Make him a God. That's
why that theology is so deadly. It's called living up to your possibilities, living up to your privileges, taking all the power that you're powerful under the power. Interesting. One of the key words, or the operative words in that modern theology, is power. Power of positive thinking. Power of the Spirit. Power, power, power. But you see, that's not the problem again. You want too much power. You see, here again, the Christian message is not that man wins the victory. The Christian message is that the victory has been won for man. Again, we are saved by grace. You understand that? It's a very clear and simple distinction. Okay, now, man uses myth to end history and make himself the absolute ruler. That is, and notice the ancient religions did this, all religions do this. Our religion does this, but in a different way. Our religion ends history without making man a god. That is, our religion ends history. And do you understand by ending history means stops this inexorable progression of defeat and misery and unhappiness? Our history, our religion ends history, but it does it without making man a god, without putting man in charge. One of the reasons it's a true religion. Why? Because God is God, and we're not God. And every other religion, in a sense, is supposed to put man in charge. Yes?
I thought ending history means it's like getting rid of badness.
Well, no, it means changing the order of things.
But still,
ultimately, yes. You mean that way it can win the justice of the earth ultimately. But it's going to, before then, and more than that, it was going to send a new order of things so that what has happened in the past, the man is goes along for the ride, he's the actor, he's going to become the playwright. It's a function of him. So in this sense, Christianity, in its full definition, now hear me, Christianity is not a man, because it does not make man the director of the playwright. It simply says that but he's more than an actor. He's a fellow heir, but he's not God. Okay. You understand that? Now, so that, what is the means of achieving the goal of death? And again, here we have another generic term, another we might call an anthropological term, and that is magic. Magic, interesting enough, Michael's in my cultural anthropology class. We're talking about magic this morning. Magic functions, magic means that this is how we use the myth. This is the handle that we have on the myth to end history. Magic has for its purpose the total control of man over man, nature, and the supernatural. Magic. And see, this is magic controls fate. Magic is there's all kinds of magic. I was talking about the repeat of my lecture this morning. I might have heard the replay on this. Overlap of subjects that we have in our modern industrialized technological educated world, mainly vestigial magic, but magic I'm not saying. I finished out the whole year without being too sick. We do that. I'm not good. Why? I'm not good. I'm not good. I'm not good.
Married on the half-mast.
questions that were asked.
But you don't let the grand jury ride on the way there, or the way there.
Take a dirty room to your house. You have a place for
you. Mm-hmm.
You are really superficial, aren't you? Well, not much. Less than him. 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 This is what the term magic means. It's the ritual. It's what we do. It's how the myth becomes operative. Understand? The myth becomes operative through magic. By the way, this is why there was always distinguished between magic and prayer. Many people, many anthropologists treat prayer as magic. And some prayer, so-called Christian prayer, is simply the practice of magic. And what does the magician do? Well, the old term magician was a witch to practice his black magic. It does control you, kill you, but you get sick. The idea of transcendent form. It's what the term magic means. Magic has for its purpose the total control of man over man, nature, and the supernatural. The rain dance, when it's rain, the rain dance. I'll call Pat Robertson, he's the one. Control over nature and the supernatural. The gods. Disciple Satan and the God on your side. So it's the element of truth in that, you see. But again, well, this is why we must always realize that when we pray in Jesus' name. And it's not we who have control, it is He by grace. Understand? It's not personal power. Any power that a Christian has is not personal power. It's the gracious gift of God. Yes?
Well, Pat Robinson prays that.
What?
Well, yeah. he wants the personal power, but he's praying in Jesus' name.
Yes, but he wants the personal power.
He's called the personal power.
That is, if you really have faith, and you'll not be sick, and you'll not be poor. You're not, your crop will be destroyed by hail.
Or just kind of proclaim Jesus Lord, and you have all that.
All that power, you see. Under the influence of Christianity, yes?
I was just thinking, some people have to say this further forward, some people have a little more clout with God. I mean, the prayer of a righteous man affects over a prayer of an unrighteous man. So that has something to do with the person.
Yes, it does. You're right. But it's not personal power in this sense. You're right. It does have something to do with it. But in that he receives more grace at that point than others receive. But I guess the difference is this, is that man, let me word it this way, your point is well taken. Let me word it this way. The difference is that in Christianity, man is not the source of the power. But now, in other religions, he's not either, but the point is that man, God does not infuse power. Maybe this is a better way to put it. That in Christianity, God does not infuse this power in man. He exercises on his behalf according to his will. And in modern scientism and in many pagan religions, power is infused in man. In witchcraft it is. In satanic worship it is. The power is infused in man. In a lot of neo-charismatic theology, same thing. Power is infused in man so he can exercise it at will. Which is not what the Bible teaches. The power belongs to God. Be of men. Never be anything but men. Power does not originate in us. And also, Jeff, the power is not at our command. See, in mythology, the power is at our command. Y'all see that? When I choose to exercise it, I will exercise it because the power is in me. Oh no. We come to God and we ask according to your will. And He says yes or no. It is not at our command. See, at every point, man is headed off the paths. Does this make any sense to you? This is quite deep. Okay. Now, under the influence of Christianity, science escaped from magic.
The ancient Greek science was magic. Ancient Greek math was magic. The Christian is God's vice regent over the earth, and science is the tool, is one of the tools, or is the tool given to man to establish and maintain that dominion. That's the proper role of science. That man is to use science to maintain his dominion over the earth on behalf of God, that God is the ruler. When science oversteps that role, it stops being science and becomes, once again, magic. And modern scientism, we're going to see, functions as magic. That is, we're going to conquer the world, right? We're going to conquer space, we're going to conquer disease, might even conquer death. What is our tool? What's our handle on all this? Science. So science becomes magic. Man is going to rule the universe. Man is destined for the stars. What's going to put him there? Science. Man is going to alter his own evolution. Because he's got a naughty gene, what's he going to do? He'll reprogram the gene. So all his kids will be like the people at Lake Wobegon. All the women will be strong, all the men good looking, all the children above average. You all know this in the Garrison Theater. Culture and your pride. What's going to make man Superman? Science. Science, science, science. The holy word of science. But what I'm saying is that with scientism, science once again has become magic. This assumes what I'm saying is, I'm not saying that every scientist is a magician or that every function of science is magical. I'm saying is that in modern scientism, science has once again become magic. That is, here it is. Let me just tie it all together. The myth, science as myth. Man is going to overcome history, which means he's going to take charge. No longer is nature going to be in charge, or whatever gods there might have been, no longer is fate, but man is going to assume control. He's going to write the play from now on. What is going to give him that control? Science. Y'all see that? Not quite clear to think about it that way. And that is our modern, that's modern man. That's the average American. In fact, if you want to sell a product, you just hang the name science on it. It's really funny how it works. If you want to see this, I'll give y'all clues on how to look for this stuff, think about it. Next time you watch a television, the commercials come on, look at all the ways, listen to all the ways the word science is used or misused to sell. A new scientific breakthrough. You know, they just hang the word science on it and say a scientific commodity, product, car wax, whatever it is, it all of a sudden becomes almost magical. By the way, you saw this, remember the commercial for a Xerox machine, a little monk? And he's supposed to copy all this stuff, he comes in with the whole staff. And I asked, how did you get done so quick? What did he say? Magic. What is it? It's a Xerox machine. Almost, isn't it? Science is the great benefactor. It doesn't kill us first. You know, it doesn't bomb us or pollute the soil so we can't eat any food or the water so we can't drink or the air so we can't breathe. It's going to save us. sarcastic. But do you all recognize this in modern thoughts? Let me ask you, do you recognize this in your own thoughts? You were educated to think this way. And I was to a lesser degree, but you were more than I was. As you can understand, conditioned to think this way. The word science is good. Science is a good word.
Oh, there is the mad science, is there? Science. We're on a science trip. It's almost as good as LSD. You're high on science. Notice at one time, the preacher was the parson, the person. He was the person in the community. Now it's the scientist who is the parson. He's the new parson. He's the new person. He's the new center. He's the new high priest. He's the high priest of modern society. Scientist. It's science against religion. There never has been any conflict between science and religion. Everybody thinks there has. There's been a conflict between religion and religion. What the conflict is.
All religion scientists.
Yeah, scientism is religion. That's what the problem is. Understand? There never could be a conflict between science and religion. Christian religion. Y'all see that? So science is the new magic. Okay. What is the purpose? Are y'all with me now? Don't overdo this, but I'll make sure you understand what we're saying as we're saying it. What is the purpose of modern science? The exercise of total control. Prediction, planning, and control. That is, science. Through science we predict what we predict the possibilities, we plan our program, and we control our future.
Control. So we decide until the nuclear plant blows up, the challenger set, the challenger air plant blows up. All of a sudden, we're surprised. But that's the idea. Understand the prediction, planning, control. What enables us to predict? Science. We plan scientifically, and what gives us our control? Science. Well, and I've already mentioned, I'll come back to the popularity of modern science. It is wedded, and science has become the new magic. That is, what the magician could do, the alchemist and the others could do in the Middle Ages, the scientists perform that function in our society. One of the things we're going to see if I have time to get to this, one of the problems in this is that the scientist is the least liberally educated man in the world at all. The most narrow. For instance, we're going to, one of the things we're going to come to, we have time, but we're going to develop the fact about this mission here. The scientists, almost all scientists, because of the kind of training they receive, are incompetent when they try to get over to the area of metaphysics. Maybe some are not competent.
Well, that's true.
What's amazing? I've read these guys, they get out of their area when they really get stupid. Okay. Isaac Asimov gets out of his area and he gets foolish. I read all those letters. Illogical, prejudicial, hysterical. I read a letter that circulated trying to raise money to fight creationism. And it was simply hysterical. It was like a backwoods fundamentalist ignorant preacher lashing out against evolution from the position of ignorance. You know, and he embarrasses himself as without being hysterical. Saying things like, if you want to be a you see these guys, but they really is. He's outside of his field. He really gets irrational.
In reference to that letter, I'll be here.
No, right. I'll turn it over. The idea that the moral majority is going to impose thought control. You know, that if you let this happen, then the true scientists will live in jail. You get off it. Get outside of the fields. Well, science is going to overcome history. Science eliminates the ethical struggle. Before, who decided what was right and what was wrong? The minister decided, the teacher decided. Right? The clergyman. You want to know what was right or wrong? You ask the clergyman, or at least the philosopher. Now, if you want to know what's right or wrong, you ask the science. And by the way, sometimes we're not too comfortable with this. But I said in the opening lecture that science cannot speak to ethics? Well, it's not because they haven't tried. When do you pull the plug? Well, I'm sure in Dean Chambers' ethics class, you deal with the delegates that they're not in some of that class.
Modern
social problems. Are you dealing with this?
Yeah.
Well, the question I would raise, I'm not going to get into that. But you know how difficult it is. Well, it's a tremendous ethical problem. When you pull the plug, as minister, by the way, you think that'd be the right purpose, because you might be asked. I've had a plug pulled when I said it before. And that would have been. In Chambers, do you think it's time? It's not big. I've been in that position more than once. And not a whole lot of times, but more than once. And but my point here is, without getting into that, the issue I'm raising is who is not what is decided, but who decides? Who decides? The interesting thing is, you see that they sort of run into the string has run out, and you realize in medical schools now they're getting professors of ethics in. Because they're trying to, because they realize that the science, that following the rules of science, you cannot address ethics. So they're trying to get some ethics. So now they have a professional ethicist. They save themselves a lot of money and just get an informed preacher. But see my point? DNA, recombinant DNA, where we actually create different kinds of life forms, not from nothing, but by rearranging information in genetic code. Okay, so you got this scientist who's going to make this major breakthrough. Is it right or wrong? The consensus in our society is that the scientist wants to do it right the way. Why? Well, that's science. Science is the high priest. Who's to say he's wrong? Now, the thing that is damning that is the nuclear bomb. Science, you know, went ahead and did it. And they said, well, you know, that's the case where he shouldn't have. But the general feeling is, understand what I'm saying? That if the scientist working in this lab wants to reorganize the genetic information and do something and produce clones or super people, super minds, even the government now is worrying about this. Trying to say, this has created an area of tension, intellectual tension. Government, Congress is talking about this. In other words, should there be control? And if so, who is going to control it? Well, you're aware of this. There's been all kinds of hearings on it. Who's going to control my only point here is that if this issue has come up, it can only come up, let me word it this way, this issue can only become a problem in a society with the mythology of where science is, where science is a mythology. And become scientism. Okay, we're talking about eliminates the ethical struggle, science seeks to eliminate the ethical struggle. That is, to say that modern scientism wants to put man, let's say, beyond good or bad. Modern scientism tends to be pragmatic. The theology of the new science of scientism is pragmatism. That is, whatever works. The question is not, of course, the beg of the question is a logical fallacy. They can get away from it. For instance, I'll show you, I mean, you trace it back to this ethics, because we're overlapped. You say, well, take abortion as a clear example, or it's a very tragic example of this. So the approach to the number is not approach ethically, it's approach pragmatic, but it's rooted in social order. Well, unwed children are not rooted in social order. So we will make it legally, turn a legal, open a legal door to give you an unwed children. Why? Because we write in the letter to convenience, which overpowers the right of the child to life. We will make that distinction because our society will be better off. Things will work better if we do it that way. Okay? Now, we're an ethical people. We're not, you can't kill a living child and then won't. Well, why not? Why did you push it back? Well, why? So it's not, abortion is not an ethical thing. Okay. By the way, I think I mentioned this before. If you think about abortion, you realize what you get when the abortion is independent, it's like how good it is. And she talks about, she's a pro-abortionist, pro-choice, talks about abortion being ethical. The mother's private moral choice, by spending that with your child, it's a child, a moral choice, it's not a child, it's not a moral choice. One person can't get a moral choice. You know, we're looking at her opinion, it's a medical choice, not a moral choice. But, okay, let's get back to the line of thought. If we trace this back, we say, well, but we want to kill living children. The answer is, why not? Why not kill them? Why not let the child born? See if you really want them or not. Give yourself a feeling for them. And then you kill them. Okay. It makes about as much sense to decide to save her from even messing around with the child. And it's going to let them do this. So there's no real good to do between the child 2 weeks before the exact time. No real good. So why not 4 weeks? Or 5? Or 6? Why not? Well, let's give the child 2 weeks after this happened the first year. 2 years. Well, maybe hit their heads up. Any child of any age would not want it. Or why not any adult of any age who's not want it? Where do you stop? Just my point I'm trying to make here, my hope I'm making here, is that you cannot, that modern scientism tries to take man beyond ethics, it does not work.
can't do it. Because pure pragmatism is a dead theology. See? Well, if you reduce it down to what, in other words, it finally gets down to, if I'm more powerful than you and I don't want you, you're done for. Then it becomes a question of raw power, understand? Unwanted by whom? I'm not really wild about my man, that's not really. I think he burdens the earth. He's in my face all the time. I don't want him.
Am I going to get him? Of course, my real problem is totally over time. And he's got to get it.
Oh, it's time for ethics.
You got that?
If the guy that doesn't want me has got this, the guy with the power, then we're going to start shouting ethics. But it's too late. So, this is one of the deadly fallacies of modern scientism. That is, who's going to decide? Science cannot decide. The modern scientism wants to. So say, well, don't this. Who decides whether the child is? Well, it's between the woman and her doctors. He's the scientist. He's the high priest in that decision. And as the poster says, leading out somebody. You understand? The doctor becomes, he's the scientist. So on what basis does he make the decision? Pure science. Yes, it doesn't work. It's reductionist. But this is what the myth tries to do. Control. Absolute control. Control of our human mind is absolute control. Well, that's one of the reasons. What I'm trying to say to you, to teach you, is that one of the reasons, not the only reason, maybe not the primary reason, one of the reasons why the babies are dying is because of this modern science fiction mentality I've been talking about the last few hours. This idea of the statement of sacred science. Which brings us, in our outline, to the sovereignty of science. In the Christian view, with God all things are possible, and with Him nothing is impossible within the realm of total reality. The view of modern scientism is all things are possible for man through and by the use of science. This is Star Wars. This is Epcot. This is Asimov. This is nonsense. I'll give you an example. Now, do you think I'm making this up? I'll give you an example. This is a sober route. Here's an example. Kenneth Huber, who's a specialist in planetary astronomy and a fellow of Britain's Royal Astronomical Society, concerned the death of the sun. The sun's burning out. Not right away. It's smaller today than it was yesterday. Scott's going on. What was that?
5 feet an hour.
5 feet an hour. So if you extrapolate this backward, the solar system could not have been as old as anything. This is what he's saying. Talking about the death of the sun. This guy is not writing science fiction. At least he doesn't mean to be. He is, but he doesn't mean to be. Still another possibility would be to construct our own sun. Oh yeah, why not? Yeah, well, the thing about it is, it'd be funny if it weren't so tragic, but the fact is that this guy's deadly sober. That's still another possibility would be to construct our own sun, a source of heat and light which might be suspended in the sky and hold the hovering demons of cold and darkness at bay. This artificial sun would operate by subatomic energy. In the remaining years of grace, man might learn how to run the carbon cycle. Give us the future, we'll do it. Hydrogen, the fuel, is abundant, and other light atoms, such as lithium, are also plentiful sources of energy. Several billions of years of time at his disposal for research, man should be able to develop cheap, abundant, and manageable subatomic power.
What would it mean, friend?
So instead of where I came from, I get off my back. I mean, give me a break, right? Give us several billion years and we'll build our own sun. That is, AIDS doesn't kill us first. I mean, that's a few minor hits. But now,
And so, and then again, I'm back to this. This is a part of this idea that we're going to try to manage to travel to the stars. It is a part of this package. Give us enough time in the future, man will be able to create that sun. We're calling people, we're eradicating all diseases. Mother, I've got an idea that God, if such things as AIDS, if God allows them, perhaps causes them directly to come along every so often to remind us how stupid we really are. And how very fragile is our existence. Well, listen, not much has to go wrong when we're done for. Not only as individuals, but as a race. And, you realize that there are many experts saying that it's very possible that AIDS might want to kill as much as 29% of the population of the world. I think it's going to full blast. Interesting though. Just thought it would be interesting. We got polio to take care of, and smallpox and measles under control, diphtheria, cholera, the old killer, tetanus, whooping cough, pneumonia, and the infectious diseases, like pneumonia, get those pretty well under control. And we even got our sin. We got freedom of sin because penicillin. Interesting how penicillin get the AIDS taken away, AIDS and herpes. You realize for a long time one of the real hindrances to sexual morality was gonorrhea, syphilis, and others, and there was no cure for it. Abraham Lincoln died of gonorrhea, probably, or syphilis. Alexander Lincoln died of syphilis. Abraham Lincoln had syphilis, gonorrhea, and his
mother.
Then came penicillin. As you go out to the Bronco on Friday night and get a shot Monday morning, everything's okay. But then came what? Herpes. What were herpes was all along? Herpes. I got a prediction right here. I believe that AIDS gets cured, something else come along. I can't prove that. And I don't. I hope that it's true. I'm just saying that. Why? Well, I think God is reminding us it's a dangerous thing to fool with Mother Nature or fool with God. But anyway, so this is a part of the mythology of science. Man shall, in effect, become God. All things are possible for man through and by the use of science. And by the way, it's another piece of this. It's the same mind. They get this mind. Listen, you teach you how this thing. You see this in that kind of thing. And this, you see it in this. It's the fallacy of extrapolation. So extrapolation becomes a fallacy. What is the fallacy of extrapolation? You know what I mean? First of all, you know what extrapolation is. What is extrapolation?
Give it enough time and take the knowledge again.
Yeah. Well, what is extrapolation? It's also worrying.
Just remind yourself.
Take a known quantity or a known process or a known and you extend it logically into the unknown. If I make 20 cents a day, I pay for a dollar, $2. I live in the fallacy and extrapolation. What is the fallacy and extrapolation?
You're assuming that nothing is working in the field.
Yes. A, you're assuming that a process which will work in the long range, shortly will work in the long range, which it won't. Now, Mark Twain, as you know, made great fun of the 19th century evolutionists who extrapolate. And he figured, in a sense, it's in the best book. That was
pages. Are you impressed?
I'm impressed.
Is Mark Twain's view, did you read Mark Twain's view on extrapolation? You haven't, you said you read it. Here's Mark, here says, he says, in the space, here's Mark Twain on extrapolation. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. Which is true. The lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That means the washing the way out, the land out, the delta. That's an average of trop over a mile in a third a year. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that the old Olytic Silurian period, just a million years ago, next November. Therefore, any calm person who is not blind or idiotic can see that in the old Olytic Silurian period, just a million years ago, next November, the lower Mississippi River was upward of 1,300,000 miles long and stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. And by the same token, any person can see that 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will be only a mile and three quarters long. And Cairo and New Orleans will have joined their streets together and be plodding along comfortably under a single mayor and a mutual board of aldermen. There's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment of fact. That's beautiful, isn't it? You got that? It's terrible. Only a few years. 742 years. The Lord, the Cairo of New Orleans will be the same town. I mean, you can't deny that. Well, now, you can see the fallacy in extrapolation. Now, let me teach you, I'm trying to teach you the same mind that extrapolates from microevolution to macroevolution, from general, from specific evolution to general evolution. That same mind extrapolates the scientific progress of the last 100 years into the next 1,000 years. And constructs thereby his dream, such as we're going to go to the sun, or we're going to travel through space. The idea, that's the common mind. It's exactly the same in my place.
You would say that the percentage of growth in scientific knowledge in the last 100 years, possibly may be.
Oh, it might be. I don't know for how long. Yeah, but to extrapolate the progress from the oil lamp to the mercury vapor lamp, to say, okay, by that process, eventually man will build a lamp that generates its own energy for its own sun, is simply not. In other words, it's the fallacy. This is exactly, I'm not making this up to you, that's exactly how modern science, the modern mind of scientists operate. It says that since we went from the candle to the computer, we will go from the computer to, who knows, like quantum leaps. It's not true at all. It's simply not true. Now, I'm not saying that amazing things won't be done, and I hope amazing things are done. I'm all for advances in modern medicine. If I go to the doctor, I'm even more for it. I'm for the improvements in transportation. I'd much rather sit in my car with air conditioning running in the stereo, playing nice music, come to me, cruising down the road and drive a horse and bounce it away. I've done my good for it. I'm not sure about the car driving. I've been a Model A. Molding. But I'd better have a newer car. And when I better get a Virginia. I'm not sure if it's why. Don't misunderstand that. No. Except the same, that they expect it. This is how they arrive at this. Understand? I know.
You see,
yes.
It's just, being a student of this thing that we were talking about last week and this week also, and have this bump in our heads, 200 years, and I hear this in the same audience, 200 years ago, and this conversation would take place at that point, somewhere.
They would have said, anybody who brought up the idea of even thinking about flying to the moon at the end of the solar system, the idea that a machine no bigger than this could do the scientific things that it could do with a computer that size, people would just say, this is an identical thing. Where did we draw a line?
And that's
what they pumped into us in our schooling.
And that is exactly the argument. You see that is a fallacy extrapolation.
They can handle 200 years.
What they're saying is, for instance, I had a guy, and I had every time I mention this, right? I don't mention it too often. I say we are not, or oil. Others say space travel is bunk. When I say that we're not. In fact, the last time I said it, I said that we're not going to travel into space. He said, it's very funny. This is the common. This is exactly what you hear. Well, now, 100 years ago, if you had told somebody about television and space shuttles and satellites, they would have said exactly what you're saying. You see the implied argument? The argument is, therefore, anything is possible. We simply extrapolate. So we're going to extrapolate what happened the last 100 years, the next 1,000 years, and the next 10,000 years, and we will certainly. It's inevitable that we'll travel. It's hard to do anything. There are those signs. That's exactly the argument. You understand? That's what I was going to say. That is exactly the argument that's given. It's what is said. And you understand it is the fallacy of extrapolation.
It seemed like even 200 years ago, 200 years ago, they've been studying extrapolation. They would have said, we deliver him a machine that says, that's a fallacy of extrapolation. I don't know that. But it would seem like that would be the same argument that we have here today.
But you say, in other words, but the fallacy of extrapolation is not that you cannot extrapolate, but you cannot extrapolate indefinitely. It doesn't go on and on and on. Other factors come in. For instance, you run into a technological dead end. You run into interfering forces. And the Cairo and New Orleans are not going to be the same city. And so things, because too many things, for instance, it's just not that simple. You understand? You run into dead ends, you run into other factors come in, interferences. Oh, yes.
Do you think we've run into a dead end as far as space goes?
No, I don't think we have. But I don't think we're going to go through space. I don't think we're going to go out and make any more advances. I think, if you want my opinion, the next frontier in space is the unmanned spacecraft. I think that is going to be the next, the great leaps forward.
Is that exactly what you
mean? Yes. But within known, within reasonable. In other words, unless you can't always predict the future, but in other words, reason comes into the picture. By the way, you don't you? The old fallacy, the logicians tell the old story of the fallacy to illustrate the fallacy of extrapolation. It's the story of the forms of it. It's a kind of ancient Greece, by the way. You find the story in different forms. So the basic story is, the form in which I first heard it was of a German farm girl who decided that she would like to be able to lift a cow. So she lifted a cat. It was just born, no trouble with it. Carried it around to the pen. The next day, the difference was so small that she could lift the cat the second day. She could lift the time she paid it wasn't half the second day, it was the first day. A few ounces. So she could lift it. And so she lifted the second day, and there was no more trouble the second day than the first day. Not that she could notice. The difference was not noticeable. The difference between lifting it the third and the fourth day as opposed to the third day was not noticeable. And so the difference between the fifth day was not noticeable. And so she kept this up until eventually the cow was full grown to 400 pounds and she could carry it around. Makes sense, doesn't it? So you extrapolate the difference between day one and day two.
Here's the other limit to your human body, which I mean,
the fallacy that is, you simply run out. Even though
even though, listen to me, when the cow is 300 days old, the difference between its weight between the 300th day and the 301st day is no different than the difference in weight between the first and the second day. Even though that's true, and all along the line, you cannot, just because you can carry a cow, pick up a cow, a cow in the early days of its life, doesn't mean you simply do not extrapolate. That's the common story of the adoption of extrapolation.
For those people that do extrapolate certain things, they must recognize that there's something that's ridiculous.
Yes.
So do they just choose what they want to believe?
But it's sort of in this romantic, when it comes to space, for instance, and other than medicine, you know, man's going to conquer. It's given enough time with the progress of the past to extrapolate the future. Which one of the problems with that is, how about extrapolating the problems? This is the most killing century in the history of the world. There's more people have been killed. I don't know, I'm talking about dying of diseases. More people have been killed by the people in this century than any century in the world. So you extrapolate back to the information. But you see what I'm saying? It's that mind, what I'm trying to teach you now is this mindset that makes the general acceptance of evolution so popular through extrapolation is the same mind that says that we'll make our own sun. It's this old dictum, I repeat it to you. This is one of my few contributions to the discussion. I laid this on my professor at the university. I said, I've written a list of unwritten rules of evolution. Given enough time, everything must happen. And need is a sufficient cause. And my experiment, given enough time in the past, anything must have happened. Give us enough time in the future, and we'll just come to hand. Well, true. You cannot extrapolate. For instance, when certain amino acids are formed through heating of gases, you cannot extrapolate that into host cells or cells or anything. It runs dry. Makes my metaphors. Did y'all see that? Well, the modern mind of extrapolation, that's the modern mind of scientific, modern mind of scientism. And it doesn't work. It's like, modern mind, you see this in all forms. You see it in the field of education. But what happens is, pretty soon you start running around in circles.
It works in the more areas of life. You don't even learn how to think about it.
when I was in Ohio, I once had a running battle with the experts in education. The guys who get their degrees and their administrators. And my university lecture, my degree, was one of the reasons I couldn't correct that. Education. Well, they use the schools in the business of their life. I went to the school my kids were in. And of course, like, they're on about a 12-year cycle. You see, there's so many ways to teach a class. Has education been improved since the one-room schoolhouse? Well, in many ways, yes. You know, we change, we improve.
How kind of has we changed and improved in the last 50 years?
Look how much we've changed in the last 40 years. So, this mind, extrapolated mind, says, therefore we shall change and improve in depth. So they keep on writing these dissertations. But you see, to improve, you have to change. To change, you do something new. There's only so many ways to teach class. Okay. No one person to teach another. So what they're doing now is going around circles. You read the history of education. How do you learn around in circles?
But
I estimate about 12-year cycle it is. That makes most of my mind now. You got that? Okay. Now we're going back to traditional. They look at a new math out of that field. Understand? They change it. It's hugely expensive. They go from the old classroom to the traditional classroom, very smart, you can teach them. And now all they're doing is going around in circles. Full education is doing it. Going around in circles, in my opinion. Why? Because that is, what is new now will be old pretty soon. But it'll be new again. Why? Because you cannot improve indefinitely. There are only so many ways to teach a class. Right? I mean, there's just basics. And you simply run out. My point is, this extrapolating mind assumes that we shall improve in depth. Not that there will be always be fine tuning to be done in the light of changing social conditions. I misunderstand that. But it's kind of like neckties. Save your neckties, boys. Why? There's only so many ways to have a necktie. And a why, and everything in between. But I threw away all my thin ties in 1965. And they're all back. I give them to you. I would wear them again. But I give them to you guys because they came back. Remember the neckties. What do they do? It's like the hemlines. They go up and they go down. Sometimes they go way up. Sometimes they go way down. But I can't go sideways. They go up and they go down. Ties go thicker and they get thinner. They get thicker and they get thinner. In 1961 it was real thin. In 1966 it was wider. And if you were really scientific, you figured by 1985 you'd be wrapped around. You know, piled like this, you know. Is my tiling okay? No, you see. Only got so wide that it started getting. And by the way, ties can only get so skinny. You know, I've seen some around that are pretty limited, you know. It's kind of like a shoestring. You get my point? After a while, take the internal combustion engine. It's vastly improved, but still internal combustion engine. You can improve the way you spark it. You can improve the way you live the fuel. You can make it more efficient than they have. But still, that doesn't mean that eventually we're going to have an engine that will run 500,000 miles on a teacup of water. You know, just with all the energy out of the water, where's it going to do that? I don't think so. you get this. There's a big debate when Roger Bannister wrote the 4-mile outdoor mile. I was in high school. Somebody raised the question, what's the perfect mile? That was supposed to be the perfect mile, right? And now we got high school kids breaking the 4-minute mile, but that was a big thing. I remember when Roger Bannister wrote the 4-minute mile. And it was determined that it was as fast as anybody. What's the record now? 352 or 353 or something like that?
349.
Yeah. You see, yeah. Now, what is the, and so we got this big discussion. What's the perfect mile? Now, if a guy can run it in 4 minutes, which is a little more exertion, he can run 359.5, right? Surely, hasten up a couple of steps along the way, run 358. Is that a 340? What's
340?
349. 349. If a man can run a mile in 349, he can run in 348. Right? Well, if he can run 348, he can run 347. If he runs in 347, he can run in 346. If you can run 340, you see, it's like carrying a cow, same thing. Well, it's a fallacy. You understand that? All I want you to understand is that it's a fallacy, and that our culture commits it in the area we're talking about. Okay. We come now to science and the utopian mentality. Making some notes for revision myself. What is the utopian mentality? What's utopia? Remember Restoration history, Robert Owen, utopianism. What is it?
Perfect
society. No unhappiness, no misery, no want. Communism is utopianism. The promise, and note this, interestingly enough, what is the philosophy, the political philosophy of the Soviet Union? What's it called? What's the real technical exact term for the political philosophy of the Soviet Union?
You might know.
Very instructive. What is it?
Scientific socialism. Scientific socialism. The promise of a workless world in which everyone lives well. The work ethic is being attacked. A lot of people are kind of working on that right now. We've got some of our students who are working on that. I don't know if it comes to academics. The promise of a workless world in which everyone lives well. Do you realize that a university that's being taught as the is being taught that that's inevitable? Why must we get rid of the Protestant work ethic? The man will not work, but the Pauline ethic is what? The man will not work, neither let him eat. You're going to get rid of that. Why? Because science is going to render physical labor obsolete. Science is going to render intellectual labor obsolete. By the way, a part of this new scientism is the idea that men and machines can think. It's interesting how many people think that, the Knight Rider? You amazed how many kids think that's plausible. R2D2. The car, which really becomes a person, it's capable of intellect. So the machines are going to now take over the manual labor. Again, you extrapolate. Go from the hose to the farm tractor to the guy who sits in the in this air conditioned cubicle and push buttons. Farm without makers. No people. Well, I'm not saying I don't know how close we'll come to that. I know that we'll never build artificial machines that will have that sort of thing in the human sense. Because you can't do that. They can compute. Computing is not thinking. You understand that, don't you? You see, there's a difference. There's a difference. There's data, there's information, and there's knowledge. And there's wisdom. Data is raw material. Information is useful raw material. But data is, let's simplify it. Information is not knowledge, it's simply information. And knowledge is not wisdom. For that reason, computers never think in the full sense. You have that? Information is not knowledge. Knowledge is not wisdom. Okay. But the idea, the part of this modern mind of scientism is that a workless world. It's inevitable, you see. Extrapolate. Look how much easier they are now. Remember the GE Carousel of Progress? Out of the Magic Kingdom. I love that. He's on the best day. He's on the best day. You always. And I can remember. I can tell that stuff, but I can remember. I'm old enough. I remember an icebox. But anyway, the idea is that machines are going to take over everything. And man is going to have to get the idea to construct a society and work those worlds. Because human work will be replaced by machines. Therefore, we're going to construct a new ethic, a new culture, a new way of living things. This is a part of it. Scientific socialism. I love that. That's one of the reasons why it's so hard for conservatives to fight the welfare state. Because behind the welfare state are the social scientists who say, well, eventually nobody's going to work. Scientists, do you understand that? That's a part of the thinking. Scientists self-consciously offer themselves as the vanguard of the new Renaissance. Who is going to lead us into this new world where no one works? Who is going to guide us to utopia? Answer, the scientists guide us to utopia, the new priest. Scientists often think of themselves as the guardian of society. Question? Well, what are the ethical requirements of the promised scientific utopia? Number one, the removal of ethical absolutes. You'll have to be pragmatic. Close. Secondly, the opening of the mind to new possibilities, unbounded optimism, about which we've been saying so much. The willingness to admit that scientific man is his own God, admit that, which leads to the removal of God. You see, in the new age of science, God simply cannot be permitted. Why? Because you can't have two gods. No man can serve two masters. Man must be God. Why? Because in this new scientific utopia, man must decide about life and death, and the human body, and man must have absolute. As we came back to what we talked about last time. What is the purpose of magic? To gain absolute control. To move up. Man wants to be in control. And you cannot have a God. You cannot have man answering to God if he's going to be in control. You can have the force. And again, this morning in Cultural Anthropology, we talked about that is the religion of animatism. Not animism, but animatism. That's a term in cultural anthropology. That is the idea that the whole universe is permeated by an impersonal, non-individualized force to which you can tap into for unlimited power. That was the theology of Star Wars. The force. Tap into it. It's there, it's in everything. It's impersonal, you can tap into it. And if you tap in front of it, you know the secret, as the Jedi Knights did, of tapping into the force, then you can become God. Overcome space, overcome gravity, energy, live forever, overcome death. Remember, who was the name of the old man who was killed by Darth Vader and his cloak and his body disappeared? Obi-Wan. Overcome death. Why? By tapping into the force. Well, it's interesting that why that kind of theology is rising. It's interesting to get rid of God, I've got to have something. The establishment of scientific absolutism, the passionate dedication to scientism. Example, the fervent, I've already talked about it, the fervent, passionate desire of those working at the space program to find evidence of life on other planets. Supposedly, science is the object. It's interesting in discovering the truth, not making a case. You see, it's interesting that the scientists, like the Russians, are frankly guilty of practice scientism. That is, the Russians very frankly say the main interest in the program, the science space program, is to prove there isn't a God. See, a scientist is supposed to seek truth, not make a case. And many in our space program are trying to make a case. Y'all don't remember this, but didn't he the first man in space was? What was his name? Yuri Gagarin. Yuri Gagarin was the first man in orbit. Russia. And when he said he came back, the first part of the announcement, I looked for God and I didn't see him. That was the point. Looked for God and he wasn't there. To which one of the American astronauts in training, who was Alan Shepard, who said, if he had stepped out of his spacecraft, he would have seen him. Open that door, baby, you'll see him. But that was the response. A good answer. But interesting, you see, Russians were trying to make a case. So much of science, you see as an evolution, you see it in much of the space program, and I'll come back to this in this, I don't tell us like a syllabus, not trying to seek truth with me. See, science seeks the truth. Scientism tries to make a case.